The countdown to Ramadan gets ever closer and still no sign of a breakthrough deal. We'll be speaking to someone who knows all the issues around this better than most, and who knows, may even play a role in deciding some of them in the future. It's Unholy. I'm Jonathan Friedland of The Guardian in London.
And I'm Yanit Levy of Channel 12 in Tel Aviv. Unholy, two Jews on the news, a deadline of sorts, fast approaching the month of Ramadan, right around the corner, March 11th. Always this moment, obviously, in the Muslim world, a moment of fasting and contemplating. But in this area specifically, in this year specifically, something that can create a lot of tension. There was this hope, Jonathan, of course, particularly by the United States, that this will bring a ceasefire, and of course the release of the Israeli hostages still being held by Hamas. But it does seem at this moment that Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas in Gaza, is more interested in sort of spreading violence, his attempts to spread violence to East Jerusalem and to the West Bank, to make this what he wanted to make it in the first place 5 months ago, all-out war against Israel.
Yeah, we've been saying that in some ways for him, there has been disappointment that this didn't spread and escalate across the whole region. He got some rockets from Hezbollah fired on the north. Many Israelis displaced because of that, having to evacuate those border towns. The Houthis from Yemen firing rockets onto Red Sea naval traffic, maritime traffic. But otherwise, the kind of regional conflagration that didn't happen. And who knows, maybe he sees Ramadan as his last shot at that. Alongside the reporting that that's what Hamas wants, have been signals that Israel has basically accepted more or less the deal. There was some foot dragging from Netanyahu about demanding this list of exactly which hostages would be released and what condition and so on, which Hamas saying, we haven't got the list, we don't know where they all are, and in fact, we would need a pause in order to get our act together to get the list together, a couple of days, a short pause to enable a longer pause. That's, as we're speaking, you and I, Thursday, close to midday Israel time. Who knows? Maybe there will be some breakthrough. We obviously hope so by the time people hear this. But it's one of those things where all the diplomatic pressure hasn't yet borne fruit. And another front of diplomatic pressure opening up with this very trenchant speech from Kamala Harris, obviously not, acting alone, speaking for the US administration, saying essentially kind of enough's enough, no more excuses, she said, about more aid going through. That has become the sort of point of the spear of American pressure, this issue of aid, wanting the more crossings open, wanting the flow of aid to increase, not interested in the Israeli position, which is, oh no, plenty is there, it's just the distribution problem at the other side. They're saying, just get it together, flood the zone, I even heard being said, just let more in. That has created huge urgency. But despite all that pressure, as we speak now, there's no sign yet of that breakthrough.
Yes, President Biden saying in front of the cameras that the ball is in Hamas's court in relation to ceasefire. Again, this was the hope of the United States that this will happen so that there is time to, as we said, release the hostages. It really doesn't look like it might happen in the next couple of days before Ramadan.
On top of all of that, a kind of additional layer of pressure on Netanyahu from the Americans came in the form of a visit to Washington and then actually to London by Benny Gantz. And now you'll think, okay, he's a minister in the war cabinet. Why? What's so wrong about that, visiting Israel's biggest ally in Washington? The point there is that Benny Gantz is from originally an opposition party. Yes, he's now in the war cabinet as a minister, but all the polls, etc., show him as the man likely to replace Benjamin Netanyahu, and this visit was unauthorized. It did not have the approval of the prime minister. In fact, on the contrary. And nevertheless, he was getting kind of the red carpet treatment, meeting the national security advisor in Washington, in the White House. Netanyahu still not got his White House visit from Joe Biden. And so that was a direct sort of, I think, message to Netanyahu, sort of thumbing their nose at him, but also framing to the rest of the world, and I think, you know, meeting the British Foreign Secretary in London reaffirmed that, that this is the man who we, Israel's allies, think we can do business with. This is the person we think we can make progress with. He is the future rather than the man currently in the job.
An interesting addition to that would be that we reported on Channel 12 this week that the Prime Minister told the embassy in the United Kingdom not to help with Gantz's trip. I mean, actively not to help, including security. I mean, this is pretty amazing. This is a man who is an important minister in the government. He used to be, not so long ago, the Minister of Defense. He needs certain security arrangements made for him. So that is part of it. And it does shed a light on what kind of relationship these two people have while they are running this war. As it stands now, Israel, in principle, agreed to the framework of a hostage deal. And this is the most important thing for Israelis right now. Hamas is not moving forward. And again, as we said, what Israel believes to be the case is that they hope to actually use Ramadan, they being Hamas and Sinwar, to use Ramadan to engulf the rest of the region in flames. By the way, parts of the Israeli government not being very helpful with this, specifically Itamar Ben-Gvir's Minister of National Security, thinking that there should be some restrictions put in place regarding the Temple Mount and the Arab Israelis. Netanyahu, in the end, realizing that is a very bad idea, his security apparatus saying the same thing to him and deciding not to put on those restrictions.
And so the interesting thing is this could have been a moment where Netanyahu would get some credit from allies. First of all, for that decision about access to the holy sites during Ramadan. And second, for apparently agreeing broadly to the terms of the ceasefire deal. But because of that issue of aid, that has become the, as I said, the sort of friction point. And that was the thrust of those remarks by Kamala Harris. The statement from British Foreign Secretary David Cameron is incredibly strong on this point. You know, you have to read it, again, do a sort of double take to realize he's not talking about an enemy of Britain. He's talking about an ally when he said, you know, essentially the same message of we're not listening to the excuses. You know, we want this to happen now and it's not good enough. And a warning at the end saying this will, how Israel behaves on aid will affect whether or not Britain, as its ally, judges Israel's compliance with international humanitarian law. That to me read like a veiled threat. You know, if you want an ally in the fora that decide Israel's compliance, and we're thinking of the ICJ and other places, you need to do this. So, that has become the big sort of obstacle, even in a week where otherwise Israel would be doing things that its allies would welcome.
Another important story that has been making headlines around the world, and particularly in Israel, of course, is the report put out by the UN Special Representative on sexual violence and conflict, Pramila Patton. This is a report, I think, to be read by everyone. It's the opposite of easy reading, but it is important because for the first time, an international body officially recognizes the fact that there was, in her words, reasonable grounds to believe that conflict-related sexual violence occurred during the October 7th attacks in multiple locations across the Gaza periphery, including rape and gang rape in at least three locations. She also says that there is information clear and convincing that hostages held in Gaza were subjected to sexual violence, and she fears they still are. This is a damning report, if ever there was one, of what Hamas did to Israeli women during October 7th, and essentially turning sexual violence into a weapon of war. And the fact that it does have the stamp of the UN on it, of a very serious, really very serious work done by Pramila Patton, who was here, who saw the footages, who spoke to witnesses and eyewitnesses and spoke to the police investigative unit and to many others dealing with this. Again, as I said, incredibly important for everyone to read and to go through. I think one of the sort of sad pushbacks against this report is what we're seeing, not only from Hamas, I mean, I don't expect those people to be honest, but the sense of the Hamas apologists in the West trying to minimize this as much as possible and saying that this, if it happened, it wasn't the grand scope, it was just isolated events. It is quite shocking to see, I have to say, Jonathan, the sort of the level of what people, including some media outlets, going out of their way really to try and say that this was really isolated events. I think we should talk, and I think the focus of what we should talk about is the denialism, but I will just mention that in the part of the report that talks about attribution, there has been critique against this report because it says this, among other things, Hamas has denied claims of harm against civilians, including the commission of rape. Given the mission was not investigative, it did not gather information and or draw conclusions on attribution of alleged violence to specific armed groups. Such attribution would require a fully fledged investigative process. In other words, there were groups saying that you have to name Hamas as being the perpetrator of this, and that is problematic that you didn't. I asked her about this, by the way, when I interviewed her this week, and she said the fact that we are not investigative, the fact that the Israeli government in some levels of that did not cooperate with us prevents me from saying that it is specifically Hamas. You know, we can just say, obviously, no one thinks it's the Belgians who did it, right? So that's where we are.
So this goes to the point you were making earlier about mm-hmm. the apologism and denialism, because mm-hmm. there were people who seized on that to say, the UN report has said that, yes, rapes happened, but they haven't said directly, et cetera, et cetera. People have seized on that. And as you say, it's not a forceful claim. But the fact that it's being made is what's interesting, because it goes to this denialism, which has been present in the conversation about October 7th, more or less since October 7th. It's been a feature of these last few months. And it's really interesting to me why there has been such a desire to deflect the claims of sexual violence specifically. And I think going back to a conversation we had, you know, at the end of last year, I think it works on two levels. I think firstly, there is an issue within the Muslim world. There will be analysts of Hamas who told us that there is a public in the wider Muslim world that would be repelled and disgusted by rape and sexual violence of this kind. And therefore, for Hamas to be have their reputation preserved as, you know, warriors of resistance rather than a bunch of rapists, they need these stories to be somehow deniable. So that's for Hamas. But for Hamas, you know, for the people we're referring to as apologists for Hamas, in a way, there is a group of, I would say they would identify themselves as being on the left, who are very keen for this to be resistance, armed resistance against an occupier. And they can sort of just about get their heads around that if, as it were, all Hamas did was kill people. You know, I put that in big quote marks. Mm. But if it's rape and sexual violence and mutilation and torture, that's much, much harder to square. And therefore, there's this real desire to say, it's not proved. Yes, we've seen evidence of women's bodies and forensic evidence, but until I see the video of an actual rape, I'm not going to believe it. Why is there that desire? I think it's because for a specific constituency of sort of left opinion, that's the taboo. Mm-hmm. That if Hamas are guilty of sexual violence, well, you really can't mm-hmm. not line up behind it, but you can't even bracket it as sort of armed resistance with the slightly heroic quality that phrase has for those constituencies on the left that we're describing. So I think this is, it's not a coincidence that this has been a real battleground. We see it about with going on apparently within the New York Times, following their reporting on this, that there are people who are trying to, you know, question the validity of the story that they've cut their coverage, but also the people involved in the coverage. This is an important battle for certain people who want to be able to, you know, put a kind of halo around October 7th and say this was armed resistance.
Yeah, I mean, I think you put your finger on it and detailed it perfectly. It's not only Hamas where these sexual violence assaults go against Islamic law and against the image that they would want to portray of themselves as warriors. It is exactly the Hamas apologists in the West, and there are more of those than I would have imagined in my worst nightmares. Again, what happens when your convictions and your feelings hit the hard stone cold truth of a wall of truth? You have to either change your convictions or try and change reality. And that is what these people are doing. They're minimizing it. And they're saying, wait a minute, it's not Hamas. It's the mob that came after Hamas. And it's not really so many accounts of this. There are much less than you think. All of that, the minimizing of this is also minimizing the women themselves who have gone through the most terrible thing that can happen to you on earth. And look, there are two things that I think we should just mention in the report that kind of got lost in the din. One is that she talks about the tampering of evidence. Now, this is a tragedy because of the fact that there are many volunteers trying to help right after and not a lot of people who realize what happened. Some evidence was tampered with. And also we have to add the fact that in Judaism, you have to bury as quickly as possible also was problematic. Now, another thing that she mentions, there are three women who are still alive and who are having, as we should probably say in these cases, trouble talking. And this is very, very understandable. So they didn't talk to her. And that is also an element that we should mention. When you talk about all these kinds of cases, you have to remember it takes time for people to come forward. And in this case, we also know that most of them were murdered. So it is difficult to build a case. She has built a case. It's a very convincing case. And what other people are trying to do is, again, to minimize this, we didn't even talk about the rhetorical aspect of saying, oh, but what about Israeli soldiers and what they're doing in Gaza, right? Because there's a picture of them holding lingerie as if that is in any way equivalent to what we are talking about here.
And just on that, the report, for those people who want to push back in that way and to say this is a both sides issue, there is something in the report. The Patton report talks about the detention of Palestinian men and women by Israelis. Describes degrading treatment, including prolonged forced nudity of detainees, inappropriate strip search. This says there are beatings, including in the genital areas. That's obviously a serious thing and has to be discussed anyway in its own right. What I think the point we're both making is there are people who are seizing on these things in order to, in some way, deflect away from the evidence that's also there in the Patton report of rape and gang rape and sexual
violence.
Which
is 95% of the Patton report, right?
Absolutely.
And, we should just talk about proportion.
But of course. But by having those elements in there, there are people who want, for the reasons we've both been discussing, to look away from that and to find something else to talk about.
Yeah, and to close this discussion, again, she is saying that this is still happening to hostages now, to men and women in captivity. Only a call for action, right? For the urgency of getting these Israelis out as soon as possible. That is the Patton report. We should dedicate a few minutes to another report, this time coming out of Israel. It is a States Commission inquiry saying that Benjamin Netanyahu is responsible for Israeli deaths. Now, I am not in any way talking about October 7th, but rather the conclusions of the commission set up after the Meron disaster 3 years ago. But this story is very much foreshadowing of what could be the State Commission inquiry into October 7th and what would be the response of Benjamin Netanyahu. So we will just briefly say what this is about. The Meron disaster happened 3 years ago on the holy gravesite of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. 100,000 people gather there on Lag BaOmer and they were trampled. 45 men, teenagers, children were trampled to death because of the way the site is organized and what happened there. So this was the commission that was sitting for 3 years to decide. And again, a scathing critique of Netanyahu himself with no operative decisions. They said that he is responsible, but not that anything should be done with that. This is how the Likud statement reads. It is unfortunate that for the first time in history, the government led by Bennett and Lapid formed a committee of investigation against its predecessor in the political right. This is a complete political provocation. So essentially delegitimizing the commission. Now, this commission sat for 3 years. It heard 162 witnesses. The commission members were a major general, a former mayor of Bnei Brak, and a judge. the result of this completely backfired on the Likud and Netanyahu. It has been, you know, criticized by everyone, saying you need to somehow say that you're responsible and you'll fix what's wrong, instead of just deflecting and saying it's everyone's fault and this was a political commission. I think it's important to just see just how the fact that the two words Netanyahu and responsibility are put together and what this does to the leader of Israel. You can't say you're not responsible. You are responsible because this is your job description, right? It's the first line in your job description. We'll go into that a little bit, I think, also with our guest.
We will. I mean, just your word there, use the word foreshadowing, mm-hmm. is crucial. I think this is almost like, look, it's a huge tragedy in its own right, but it is like a little trial run, mm-hmm. of what's going to happen. First, it takes 3 years for a relatively contained episode in Mount Meron. How long is any state and commission of inquiry going to take into the events of October 7th, which is obviously bigger on every possible measure? Second, the notion that there's tons of criticism but no sanction. There will be people worried that any inquiry into October 7th will be big on words, but maybe not action. But third, I think you've put your finger on the crucial point, which is this allergy that Netanyahu has to ever taking responsibility. And yet, there's a proper commission of inquiry that has pointed the finger very directly at him. Even then, he will duck it and always do that sort of Trump maneuver, which is always to say the institutions are biased and it's politics. Taking responsibility is what you're meant to do. And that is a case made, in fact, by our guest this week. A very special guest, because he is often talked about as somebody of could be a future prime minister of Israel, but is heard from, certainly in English and by an audience outside Israel, very rarely. People are hugely interested in what he has to say because of how he is talked about. And that talk has only built in recent months. People wondering if this is, and that we're about to hear from, the future prime minister of the state of Israel.
Yossi Cohen was the director of the Mossad, Israel's National Intelligence Agency, for 5.5 years. During his tenure, Israel conducted some of the most daring operations against Iran's nuclear infrastructure. He rose through the ranks of the organization for 38 years, and among his various roles, recruiting and handling spies in foreign nations. He was also Israel's national security advisor and the chief Israeli official in charge of managing Israel's clandestine relationships with Arab nations, deeply involved in the Abraham Accords. It was reported in the past that Netanyahu saw Yossi Cohen as the man who would eventually one day succeed him in the Likud. That relationship has grown colder since, but that does not deter him from contemplating maybe entering the political arena. Many see him as a man who will one day be Israel's prime minister. That was a long introduction. Yossi Cohen, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much, and it's for having me this morning.
I have to begin with, try explaining this to me if you can. As head of the Mossad, I think you oversaw one of the most daring operations that we know of, Mossad agents breaking in, or agents breaking into the secret Tehran warehouse, retrieving the Islamic Republic's nuclear files, essentially its nuclear military plans. How did we manage to do that 2,000 kilometers away? Well, we couldn't manage to figure out what Hamas is doing 100 meters from the border, right under our noses.
Right. I believe this is one of the biggest problems and one of the biggest questions that we do have till today. I mean, before the end of the war, I think that these questions will be not completely answered by us citizens, and I'm a private citizen, but I have to refer to what I've done in my past in order to try and explain your very deep and important question. Mm-hmm. How did that happen to us? I think that if you go back to part of what we did at the Mossad, I never did anything alone. I had thousands of subordinates, working with me, very brave men and women working in undercover in very tough countries. We're all based on one very, essential topic, which is we don't know everything. We know that we don't know. And when you deal with intelligence, every time you deal with intelligence, when you read reports, you have to know that you don't know everything about everything. You know something about something, or you know something about the pieces, in the puzzles that are missing. And this is something that has to be all the time remembered when you deal with tough operations that are 2,000 or 3,000 kilometers away from here, or maybe longer than 3,000 kilometers away from here. Same story applies, I believe, for the story in the, borders neighboring our country. And this is something that, to me, as an intelligence officer, I have to admit, hard to explain. The distance matters a lot. I mean, we don't fly above other countries as frequent as we can do above, let's say, Lebanon, according to foreign reports, and some, of course, above Gaza Strip. We don't use as many relationship, and we don't share, I mean, the same borderlines as we have physically with this Gaza Strip, which is eventually a very well-placed advantage to the hands of Israel. Mm-hmm. So it makes the answer a little bit even more complicated. One, I believe that a nation has two lines of defense. The first line of defense is the intelligence. You have to know what the enemy is planning for you. And we have to be there alerting ourselves first, and then the army, and then eventually the what we call the war cabinet, or any cabinet that is eventually in a position or should be in a position to take a very serious decision about the enemy plans. What do we do with it? Mm-hmm. The Gaza case is a very sad story. Mm-hmm. I think that if I go to the bottom line after this maybe too long explanation is that we didn't have enough intelligence probably. And we didn't have enough intelligence amid to the non-distance existence in between us and them, that many Gazan people have entered Israel. I'm not sure what we've done with them. Have we recruited part of them? Did we have enough human intelligence? Did we have enough sources, SIGINT sources? I'm not sure that we had enough of all that. The result says that we may had two failures. One, we didn't have enough. Two, we translated what we have, what we had wrongly. Both are an option.
Well, I'm reminded of the report that followed 9/11, that 9/11 commission, and it said this wasn't only a failure of intelligence, it was a failure of the imagination, that had been the big strategic mistake. And in this case, it looks like that for this reason, and I wonder if you see it this way, which is that people making the decisions couldn't imagine that Hamas were plotting this, because they believed in the so-called concept, the conceptia, that Hamas were deterred, that the Palestinians had become essentially irrelevant, that the focus now was on the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia. And therefore, even if there was good signal intelligence and human intelligence, they weren't putting those pieces together because of that failure of the imagination. What do you make of that
view? Right. Well, learning about what has happened at the 9/11 now, and I, you know, for many years, I mean, you need to mention that I've been working internationally with my counterparts too, the CIA, the FBI. And what they have told us, I mean, at the beginning is that they a little bit envy the Israeli system, because the Israeli system, I mean, think about us. I mean, we're small, we're a little bit tight in between ourselves. So the relationship normally in between our local FBI, the Shabak, Mossad, the IDF intelligence are super close. I mean, we live in the same neighborhood and we do share into one, we call it the pool, all intelligence from all bodies, except maybe very, very, very sensitive sources that would not enter into that pool, but will be shared in a discreet manner. 9/11 eventually was not about imagination. It was like they didn't see the pieces together. I mean, probably one of the bodies saw the borderlines. One of the bodies saw what's going on in the training facilities of their, I mean, trained pilots, and maybe the immigration department. And they didn't have an American full view, full picture about the intelligence they probably had. And that's the American problem. Well, imagination is an important asset. In operations, you have to be imaginative. I mean, in order to get somewhere, you have to visionize it. You have to say, I know it's beyond the mountains of imagination or behind a lot of barriers. Like Yonit mentioned, I mean, the seas of the nuclear archive. That was beyond imagination in a way. But we imagined that. We wanted to get there. So it's not only about a vision. It is, what do we do to get into that mission? And we had very few people in Iran on that case that were partnering on that very discreet Iranian MOD, Ministry of Defense, mission to hide their filthiest secrets about the nuclear bomb. And we knew about that. I think that the problem of Gaza is, again, imagination was there. I think that many reports claim that they knew. So they have imagined something like this that could have happened, but they ruled it out. They said, maybe we can imagine that, but that's too imaginative. Okay, so we disclose. I mean, we ignore that in a way. I mean, think about what has happened. I mean, on that very holiday of ours, I mean, Sukkot and Simchat Torah and October the 7th, intelligence is coming in. Eventually, it was alerted, right? It is alerting, I mean, part of our very important generals, I mean, including, I believe, the chief of staff and chief of Shabak. And so everybody's saying something's happening. It is.
In the night between Friday and Saturday.
Between Friday and Saturday, 3 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, there is something's coming up. And nevertheless, it was, I mean, imagination said it may. Reality says it will not. And you're right, Jonathan, imagination won. Theirs, not ours.
Yes, theirs.
Unfortunately.
Sadly, it was theirs.
I hope I answered your question. I mean, it's...
Well, my point in a way was just that the conception had been that Hamas is deterred and therefore didn't people weren't on their guard. That was really the...
That's only part of the conception. I mean, I think that... Well, I think it has to be understood or explained that in between nations, the last thing that they want to do is a war. In between country and terror organizations, I believe the last thing that they want to do is a war. I mean, you don't want to conduct a war if you don't have to. I mean, this is something that I believe all countries are trying. By the way, 10 years earlier, prior to this attack, we had Protective Edge, Tzuk Eitan in Hebrew. Protective Edge was not a wanted war. What we've tried to do is the other way, right? The other way around. I mean, we've tried to convince the Hamas not to enter into another round of violence in between us and them. And we, the entire thing was ignited because of the...
abduction of three teenagers.
Exactly. Right? The abduction of the three boys. And we were looking for the three boys in Judea and Samaria. Okay, we were looking for them there. Of course, we had to arrest some Hamas people. We have to go into their houses, into their commands, whatever. And Hamas in Gaza said, ah, we don't like what you're doing, the Judea and Samaria, so why don't we attack you a little bit with rockets? We said, don't come in. And they did. So we had to go in. But that was like a kind of a thing to explain that we did not rush to a war. I mean, we do not like to have kind of an open conflict if we don't have to. So it's not a concept that I believe is to be designated to our local Hamas-Israeli conflict. It is a worldwide thing. If you don't have to fight, don't fight. One of the directors of the CIA, we've mentioned the Americans, when I complained about us not doing enough, all right, about our own sisters, she said, probably, Yossi, your systems or generals are like ours. They don't like to fight. And this is, I'm not sure if it's a global thing, but there is a kind of a conceptual theories that would say, let's try to live peacefully with them. Let's try, because a war is a tough thing and not all the time wanted.
But isn't that exactly part of the mistake? I mean, you had a significant role in that, creating that infrastructure that allowed the transferring of money from Qatar to Hamas, because we thought they don't want war. We thought the right thing to do was to placate them and to convince them that if they have a life of more prosperity, they will not want war. Well, we didn't want war, but they did. So looking back on that, was that a mistake in your mind?
For sure it was. And not because of us. I mean, because, I mean, I can't blame terror organizations for being terrorists, right? Yeah. I can fight them till the last one of them or being killed. But the thing is that we were trying to, as you whatever, wrongly or correctly, call it the concept. The concept was to try to split, make a pure split in between Hamas as a terror organization controlling by force the Gazan people and the Gazan people as a different sector. Like two different departments in our own brains. One says, let's try to help the poor Gazan people. That was the main target of these deliveries. By the way, the Qatari money, I'm sure it's going to be asked, so let's do it right now.
I did actually ask about the Qatari money, didn't just, I? Specifically.
Right. And I was part of being in touch with countries that are not in touch with us. By the way, the Qataris were the not the only ones being persuaded by me to donate money to the Gazan people.
Interesting.
Interesting. Okay. They were not the only ones, right?
Mm-hmm. And by the way, who were the others?
So, I'm sorry.
Who do you want to tell us who the others were?
I don't think I can tell you this now, right now. But okay. But one day I will, Yonit, I promise, Jonathan mm-hmm. too. The thing is that we were trying to help the Gazan people, and mm-hmm. and the only thing was very well controlled. This is what we believed by our Shabak, mm-hmm. and we had a list of people: doctors, nurses, drivers, teachers. I mean, all these social workers. I mean, we believe that they should receive the money to make Gaza better place for them, okay? While ignoring or not separating enough, Hamas is a terror organization from all that. Mm-hmm. So in no way we have delivered money to Hamas. Never we did, mm-hmm. okay? And the mitigator in between, remember the famous... El Amadi, I mean, they called him the Qatari ambassador, mm-hmm. he came over. His job was to enter Gaza Strip again and again and again and to make sure that this money will be eventually spreaded or donated to the right people. Mm-hmm. Hamas took mm-hmm. over this money too, okay, and probably confiscated it in a very brutal way mm-hmm. to his use. But that was not the only thing that the concept did. Hundreds of trucks a day, 20 to 30,000 employees, workers coming through our borders. Thousands are crossing Israel mm-hmm. to go to Allenby Bridge to cross over to Jordan so it can go out abroad. Partially they go to train in Iran and in other places too around the world. Partially, I mean, there are students or people that are wanting to do the Hajj or mm-hmm. or other stuff. I mean, in Jeddah, in Makkah, mm-hmm. and so forth. So, the concept was, I believe, a very important, intensive trying for, I would say, coexistence. Mm-hmm. In fact, passages were open all the time, every day, back and forth. They were coming in, we were going there, not Israelis, but we were there. I mean, look at the list of organizations that were busy under this concept, not because of us, because the world pushed us to do it. I mean, USAID, you know what the size of USAID help in Gaza, UNRWA, I mean, look at what we found about them. Not surprising, right? Mm-hmm. But we had found, I mean, dozens of organizations, Turkish ones, Norwegian ones, Europeans ones, EU ones, whatever. I mean, American ones and others. I mean, all UN whatever bodies, I mean, UNICEF and more, mm-hmm. pushing Israel to let them help the Gazan people. That was not meant to help Hamas. Nobody wanted to do that. Mm-hmm. Neither the state of Israel. Unfortunately, that was a mistake. I believe that part of the concept is to be understood that as we see it today, what do we see today? Do we see today that under the unwanted humanitarian crisis, and of course, personally, I'm not in favor of any humanitarian crisis, not here, not elsewhere. Mm-hmm. I'm quite a liberal person, and I want anyone around the world living correctly, if he's not terrorist or he's not threatening the state of Israel or any other citizens around the world. But what do we see today? There is a huge international pressure on humanitarian aid. Would that go to Hamas? Could you guarantee that the bread that goes in or the medicines that go in, the medical equipment, the hospitals, can anyone guarantee, the French, the Jordanians, the Americans, can anyone guarantee that the aid that has been either passing through the crossings or being parachuted by airplanes from above, can you guarantee that this will not help terrorism? Could you guarantee that something that goes in will eventually go only to the innocent part of Gaza? And there's a lot of innocent part of Gaza, mm-hmm. right? Of course we cannot. Nevertheless, we have to do it.
You've mentioned the series of mistakes at different levels, some 3 years ago, some more recent. Is it conceivable to you that those mistakes were only made by the various intelligence chiefs, people doing the job you did in the past, or military chiefs, and that the prime minister himself was not responsible for any of those mistakes? Is it plausible that they're all responsible for what happened, the failures that led to October 7th, and he is not responsible?
I can't speak about other people's responsibility, not because I can't, because I don't want to. I think that and I refer to that in the past too. I think that responsibility is being taken by you when you sign up into your new job. Okay, like now you are responsible together with your team about this, the success of this podcast. Okay. No one out of the room could be. I mean, when you entered this, I mean, when you open the camera, that's your responsibility that this will fly nicely, right? When I received, was nominated to be director of the Mossad, I felt a huge responsibility from day number one. I remember the first morning. It was January the 6th. I was about to receive thousands of people under my responsibility. Everything that happens to them because of my leadership is my responsibility. I mean, it's not, it has nothing to be negotiated here. It's not negotiable. Responsibility is nothing to be either split or to be given by someone else to you. You are taking it when you entered the office. I think that applies strategically to everybody. It is true to a bus driver. I mean, he doesn't have to have a responsibility given to him by someone. When he enters the bus and he has 45 kids, okay, running in between whatever, the tough streets or whatever roads that can be eventually of danger, I mean, he is responsible. The only one.
So between the lines, you are saying to us the Prime Minister is responsible for what happened on October the 7th.
I would say that everyone should crucify a little bit himself, judging himself openly and decide by himself if he is responsible or not. I'm not going to blame or to charge anyone with responsibility if he's not capable of doing it by himself.
If you were Prime Minister at the time and this colossal failure happened, would you stay Prime Minister?
I think that now it is not the time to discuss changes of the government. I think it is too early to judge what has happened, mm-hmm. Even though I refer to failures. Mm-hmm. But I truly believe that a major change should happen after the war. I think that two things should happen. Mm-hmm. One is the investigating committee that should mm-hmm. be the deepest ever. I mean, because mm-hmm. we cannot allow ourselves that another thing like that would happen never again. Mm-hmm. And when I say never again, as we said about the Holocaust, we mean never again, okay? Mm-hmm. Nothing like this could happen, not with Hezbollah, not with Hamas, not with the Iranians, not with any other existential or non-existential threat that may happen to the state of Israel should not mm-hmm. happen.
And so that, an official state's inquiry, okay, that should happen.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is the results of it. And the results of it should be, I believe, that after so many people have taken the responsibility already, they eventually will be replaced. And I think that the politicians should take a very important step towards a big change mm-hmm. in the Israeli arena from now on.
That means elections, right?
That means elections, mm-hmm. I believe.
But you said there shouldn't be a change until the war is over. There are some who believe that because of that thinking, the people making the decisions, including the person at the top, Prime Minister, therefore has an incentive for the war not to be over because it puts off that moment.
I listen to this argument, I mean, frequently, mm-hmm. I say. I don't think that this is a fair argument to claim the government of wanting the war to continue just because of their political resilience. Mm-hmm. All right. I don't think that this is something that should be claimed. I think that they would be very cautious on continuing even one unwanted or unneeded day mm-hmm. of war because of political reasons. I can't imagine that this is the case. Nevertheless, you know, the people of Israel today are in a very tough situation, I have to mm-hmm. admit. I mean, it's hard. It touches every one of us. It touched my family, probably yours too, and mm-hmm. other people that we know. I mean, we have casualties, we have people being kidnapped and tortured and raped and all that, and we know them. I mean, I'm still dealing with the hostages' families. Like yesterday, I had a very important meeting with one of the families that have lost most of their mm-hmm. Brothers and sisters, and that hurts. I think that starting a kind of a political campaign while dealing with it is asking us Israelis for too much. I know and I see the voices, the demonstrations and everything. We will still have time to change the government and to change responsibilities and to change commanders and command generally, I mean, above the entire Israeli arena when the time comes. I don't think that will take longer than a few months. Mm-hmm. But within a few months, yes, I'm absolutely in favor of going into the big change.
And are you going in?
I haven't decided yet to go in.
You haven't decided. What's your deadline? Because obviously there are going to be elections soon.
I don't have a deadline because I'm not holding the timers. I mean, nobody knows really how long the war would be and what's going to be the outcome of the war. Mm-hmm. I hope that we're going to win the war. I hope that we're going to bring home all hostages, which is, to me, vitally, not only to me, to us, vitally important. I think that everybody should demand that from the government by all means. And not only from our government, from the Qatari government, from the American government, from the American administrations, from everybody that is dealing with it, from the Arab nations too. But we don't know when all that eventually will be over. So it is super hard, even personally, to predict.
No, on this, I was just going to say, when you say you haven't yet decided, what does it depend on? What are the sort of forces that will make you able to make that decision?
First, I mean, the one should decide if he wants to go into this very
quagmire. The word quagmire comes to mind.
Exactly, and this is kind
swamp.
Well, I'm not sure, but you know what? I prefer to say that instead of looking at that as a political decision, I should refer to that as a leadership decision. Should I or shouldn't I believe that I want to be part of what is so much needed within the Israeli people and be part of the leadership? And this is a decision that I and my family, we have to take. And it's a very deep discussion. I'm not saying that we ignore that. I listen to the audience. I listen to my friends and my family. And I know I can understand part of the expectations. Mm-hmm. But it has to be a very, it's not a tough decision though. It is a decision that has to be practically done and to go to plunge into this whatever swamp you said. Maybe you're right. I mean, it's a big decision. You know what, because of, again, one thing, it's huge responsibility. It's not a game. I'm not doing it for me, as I did for almost consecutive 42 years. The army, then almost back to back at the Mossad, I served the country. I was not expecting the country to serve me in return. That was one-sided thing. I'm there to serve the country and the people of Israel or the Jewish people. Or in many times, like in the UK case, I mean, we were there to save British lives too, in many ways. And the cooperation that I had with the MI5 or the MI6, the James Bonds, right? I mean, the MI6, it was wonderful at my time. And we shared a lot in order to save people's lives without expecting anything, neither from the audience, because they knew nothing about what we did, nothing for the country. Beside, at the end of my funeral, they would say, thank you very much for what you did. This is it. This is what we wanted. Mm-hmm. It is huge responsibility to go into the Israeli leadership, okay? And it needs kind of a very serious decision from myself.
While we're talking, just think of how many secrets you're still carrying with you. I wish we had time to talk about that. But I want to ask two things again about, I'm sorry that I'm dragging you into politics. First of all, would it be an easier dilemma for you if Benjamin Netanyahu had already been away from the political arena? And are we right to assume that wherever you go, it will be somewhere in the Israeli right or center right?
Well, again, I think it's a hypothetical thing because as far as we've explained, I have explained it like a few minutes ago, I don't see any political changes right now in our Israeli system. And number two, I was raised as a liberal, very liberal rightist, okay? Very liberal. I mean, the very is to the liberal thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that I'm rightist in terms of what, or the connectivity in between me and what we have to do when we see a threat to the country. There I go very right. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm not an extremist, but I go to the right. I would say probably things that Jabotinsky wrote at the time. This is something that I could refer to, right? Mm-hmm. The real Iron Dome, I mean, in the past, or the Iron Wall. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I think that I hate. I will be always very, very determined. This is what I did. I fought enemies most of my years, and I am planning to do that if we'll be responsible for that. I mean, in the rest of my time. Mm-hmm. On the other things, I'm very liberal. I'm super liberal in the way that the State of Israel should be conducting itself from now on. I mean, human rights, genders, equalities, and so forth. I believe that we have to be very liberal in between us, Israelis, understanding that we're different. And we're so different and so colored, mm-hmm. like in so many shades. Like there's so many things that has to be eventually understood in between ourselves first. So we have to be liberal enough to be united enough. And I would say that the State of Israel now is expecting two important things mm-hmm. from now on. Two feasts, okay? One is defense and security, which is hugely important. We have to make sure, as we claimed this morning again, nothing like this would happen again. And on the other hand, we have to unite. We have to understand that we have to kick out, really, I mean, from our society, all these that will try to split us again. I'm very much worried about feast number one and feast number two.
So on just perhaps more in the area of fist number one, in terms of security, the Biden White House and many, many others, in fact, governments all around the world and plenty of people inside Israel have come to the conclusion that the existence of a Palestinian state is in Israel's own security interest, mm-hmm. that it will, for one, among many other reasons, that it will unlock a regional breakthrough, particularly with Saudi Arabia. That's their position that it's articulated very explicitly now. We know that the current Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, explicitly against the existence of a Palestinian state. Where are you on that question?
Well, first, history changes, I mean, all the time. I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu claimed, I mean, in the Bar-Ilan, very famous speech, two-state solution, two states for two peoples. I mean, he claimed that again and again and again and again, and he was traveling sometimes with me to the White House for negotiations and discussions with the Palestinians himself. All right. When I was his national security advisor, the country's national security advisor, we've conducted negotiations, I mean, by a mediator. His name was Secretary of State, Mr. John Kerry, for long months. And we were there trying to get a framework for negotiations to resume talks with the Palestinians so they will have one day a Palestinian state. That was Benjamin Netanyahu thing. I believe that, fast forward to these days, I think that what we're seeing today is a kind of a Israeli audience countering that idea right now. So I know the Saudis very well, according to foreign reports, and not only, I mean, here I am, okay? I know them very well. I know what they think about the Palestinians. I know what the other Arab nations believe that the Palestinians could do for themselves. Most of them believe that they have used too much their case, but not coming to negotiate for a future state themselves. Instead of that, I mean, they've lost Gaza Strip for another terror organization. That's why they do not have a proper, I would say, elections in Ramallah, so Hamas will not take over what was left of the Palestinian Authority. To negotiate right now a Palestinian state with these non-existent body is not less than ridiculous, or not more than ridiculous. I think it is not, it can't be even done physically, because what we have today is three-state solution. You have a Gazan state, which belongs to Hamas, or shortly would not. You have a, whatever, West Bank or Judea and Samaria state that belongs to us and them together. And we have the Israeli proper state, which is eventually in the middle, like the partition plan from 1947. This is what we have. So where are we going with that? And by the way, it's very interesting to listen, not only to the Americans, which I listen very carefully, and I appreciate the American administrations a lot. I don't, from within, I'm bipartisan. Okay, I do care what they think. I do care about their vision about us Israelis, because we're super connected and somehow depend on the American administrations. But I should listen to what the Palestinians want as well. And by the way, I suggest that all of us will have a 3.5 minutes view on Khaled Mash'al's last video after the war. And he said, two-state solution? No way. We will never accept the existence of the State of Israel. So there is a lot of way to bridge, okay, before we go to this claim or statement, let's have a two-state solution and everything will be solved. It has to be eventually differently orchestrated within the Israeli system. I agree. What do we want? Where are we going with all this? How do we promise our kids and I do have, thank God, kids and grandkids already. How do we promise them that this will be the last war? That's an important responsibility. And number two is, how do you orchestrate the Palestinian Authority as well? I mean, who is there? Do they want to negotiate? Do they really care about the future of the Palestinian state? Can they do that? Can they bring Hamas under their authority's wings so they can tell them, okay, now you do what we're telling you? So I think that listening is one thing. Being realistic is a different thing. But I think that, Jonathan, you're right. I mean, we have to play differently. I know my good friends, leaders in the Middle East and in America too. I've met personally presidents of the USA. Okay, I mean, definitely Mr. Biden, and before that, of course, President Trump and President Obama too. The Palestinian story is all the time there. The two-state solution is all the time there. Everybody's trying to do that. Everybody's trying to not only to push us, but to push them too, okay, to come and to negotiate for some kind of a solution. I think that when the state of Israel is fighting, okay, against the terror organization who eventually confiscated, I would say, a half, okay, less by territory, but the major stake of the Palestinian future state, we can't really discuss a Palestinian authority being as one body with the full authorization to create a Palestinian state. But it has to be differently conducted right now.
But in the future, your children, your grandchildren, is the two-state solution the right solution, if it's possible, in your view?
It depends on many factors that are now, I would say, moving parts. I mean, the moving parts are what's going to be with the future of Gaza. You have 2.2 million people. You have, let's say half of the Palestinian population. What's going to be with this territory? We can't ignore that there is, or there are, not only this factor, but there are a kind of a corrupted Palestinian Authority. There is a kind of corruption on their side. There is a kind of a lack of authority on their side. There is a kind of a unwanting spirit. There is a huge wave, again, of local and incitement from within the Palestinian Authority officially. This has to be changed. They have to accept us as an Israeli Jewish state. I mean, they cannot ignore our existence, not then, not now, not ever. So to go there, all these factors has to be changed. I have to listen, okay, to Palestinian leaders that are saying, forget about Hamas, they do not exist anymore, we don't care about them, okay? Rule them out. I mean, ignore what they had been here, but they're not longer willing and wishing the annihilation or calling the annihilation of the state of Israel, not anymore. This is something of an important and significant statement that we don't really hear. The contrary is so. I mean, part of the Palestinian Authority members are saying, well done, Hamas. They are right. That's because of the occupation of whatever from 67 and so forth. I mean, and this is not the spirit to go into one room to discuss a kind of a solution. Mm-hmm. Are we going to go through a two-state solution one day? Maybe yes, mm-hmm. but it has to have a lot of geopolitical, I would say, changes, dramatic changes, mm-hmm. not only on the Israeli side, which is eventually needed as well, but on the Palestinian side too. Mm-hmm. Not ignoring the Americans, though.
Well, the Americans is a whole other topic, but just in your previous roles, you would have very often been asked to give an assessment of how you see things. I would just want to do that exercise here with two things. One is, you talked about Hamas being gone from Gaza at some point. What is your assessment of the extent to which they have been militarily degraded over these last 5 months? Mm-hmm. The night before we're speaking now, there were rockets over the Galil region of Israel. It's as if they're still there, mm-hmm. despite everything that's been thrown at them over 5 months. What's your assessment of their capacity? And the second question is, what's your assessment of the talks about release of hostages and a ceasefire? You've been directly involved in those conversations at an earlier stage. Do both sides, Hamas and the government of Israel, truly want this deal, or is one or both of them sort of shadow boxing because, for other reasons which you might tell us, they don't yet want a deal?
Right. If counting on official reports that I receive, Hamas has been dramatically hit by the IDF. This is not the ball game that we know. This is a new ball game. I think that we don't, everybody is counting the numbers of rockets being hit the state of Israel recently, and today it's zero, very close to zero. I think that this is a very significant issue to be relayed on the damage that Hamas suffers. And by the way, I'm not sure that the war is going to be over tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I think that IDF is planning to continue the war inside Gaza till we'll have a more decisive picture rather than assessment. Okay, it goes back to what I think. It has to be eventually mentioned, or it has to be seen, that Hamas is no longer the ruler of Gaza Strip. And that goes to their military capacity, that goes to their political capacity. And this is, I'm not sure that this is the case right now. We do see them controlling, I mean, the all these lines of trucks that they're eventually again confiscating or robbing away from their own citizens. I mean, we see all that they're still there. They're still, I'm not sure if they kick and leave, I mean, the same way they did in the past, but they're still there. Number two, for the hostages, I want to believe, and then I'll push that belief too, that this government of Israel will eventually create the best alternatives for hostages deal. I hope that this will happen and will happen soon. I mean, the days are super tough in Gaza Strip on day-to-day life. It is unbelievably tough when you see, I mean, when we have, I mean, ask the hostages that were released, I mean, about their
experience, what
experience
they went
through, in these tunnels and so forth. And winter is hard, and we have to hurry up. We have to hurry up. The prices will be high because the starting point on October 7th was super low. So we're going to pay, and we have to be ready to pay. I'm not claiming that we have to pay everything, okay? But we will pay a lot, and Hamas knows that. Otherwise, they wouldn't have kidnapped our babies, women, children, kids, men, soldiers, women soldiers, all that. I mean, they've done that because they know us. They know that we will do a lot to release them, and we will.
You know, you're a very busy man, and we reluctantly have to let you go, but I won't do that before I ask for some source of optimism. And as you said, according to foreign reports, you know the Saudis well. Is that the ray of light we're looking for? Is there a chance that we are looking at an option of a normalization that
Absolutely, yes. I mean, optimism, I want to refer to 2 points, with your permission, Yanit. One is, you know, the Saudi treaty. I mean, it was already said publicly. They accept us. They know us. They accept us. Okay, we're dealing with the conditions. I mean, by the way, I think that the major stake of normalization that Saudis are doing is not with us, it's with the Americans. It has to be endorsed by the superpower, right? I mean, it is not only in between us, Israelis, and them, Saudis, whom I know, again, very well. It is in between the three of us. So there's give and takes, okay? So now that we've agreed that we're going into this direction, let's negotiate. And this is what is happening. And I think it is happening for some years now. We're closer than it was like far away again. It's getting closer again. I think that in the end of the road, okay, there is a huge light that would say, yes, Arab nations, best Muslim friends will be better friends with the state of Israel very soon. Second point of optimism is us Israelis. I mean, I see a lot, millions of super super good Israelis that are helping each other, that are supporting each other, that are volunteering all over, our wonderful commanders and soldiers right now that are doing their best, sacrificing their lives for us to live better. And I think that we had life in Israel. We will have life in Israel for a long time. It will be good in our defense. It will be better in our unity. And it will be good in our socially from within the Israeli people in arena. Our economy will eventually recover, I believe, from this crisis, as we've done in other crises in the past. So I'm super optimistic, knowing us Israelis and the Israeli spirit.
I don't want to break the optimistic mood at all. I just want to ask one last thing.
That's what he's here
Jonathan,
for.
Jonathan, leave it that way. It's nice. It's hard enough in Tel Aviv. I mean, come on.
A little bit of cloud from London. You mentioned the superpower. And referring to the United States,
A lot of people have been very struck by how little power the superpower seems to have. It's very clear they want Israel to stop. Kamala Harris, the vice president, said so. Mm-hmm. And yet Israel just is doing what it wants to do, appearing to ignore the pleas from Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Tony Blinken,
I mean,
how much power does America actually have here?
Okay. I mean, it's not a question that I should answer, because I think that the level of cooperation that we had between us and the Americans is wonderful. I know them very well. I mean, they do like a lot. They do care a lot about the state of Israel. I mean, President Biden came all the way, and that was so significant, so different, so unique. Mm-hmm. All right. I mean, these statements that, I mean, physically coming here is a huge thing. All right. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't really mess up with America. And when he say don't, okay, they do listen to him. Mm-hmm. I mean, enemies and so forth. So we are listening to the Americans. Nevertheless, state of Israel is sovereign to run its own policy, right? It's in a simple way, it's our war. Yeah. Okay,
it's their ammunition and their money, isn't it?
It's their ammunition and their money. This is something that I believe, or either will be continued intensively, or eventually will be played differently. But I don't want to offer different games today. Mm-hmm. I think that you're right. Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean, when you fly F-35s, you do not produce its spare part by yourself. So you depend. By the way, every country that buys, defense for itself from foreign countries is getting depend in a way on the country that was selling them their ammunition or other parts. But I trust them Americans to understand us. I trust us Israelis to listen to the Americans. Mm-hmm. And I trust both ends to know that each of our countries has its own policy to follow, which is not countering the other one, all right? That could go along with just explaining who we are and what we're facing, all right? So demanding, I mean, if America is, I don't think it's true, but let's say it's true that America is demanding us to stop the war, we can't stop the war as long as Hamas is still there, as we said, live and kicking, right? I mean, it has to be eventually totally seized. So how this has been communicated to the American administration, I don't know. I hope it is being communicated rightly, and let's hope that this kind of relationship will continue. UK is important. France is important. Other nations in Europe are important. I mean, Latin America is important beside, you know, I mean, this funny statements that we, that funny, I mean, it's not funny at all, that we hear coming from Africa is important. I mean, Arab nations are important, but each one of these countries has its own policy. What do we do? When I run what I called the discreet high diplomacy, I mean, speaking to leaders around the world, about us, Israelis, it has to be explained, what do we do? Nevertheless, we did what we did, and we signed peace treaties with four countries simultaneously, okay? We can't say that they don't like the Palestinians, or they like the Palestinians more than we do, or less than we do. I mean, the game was, or the high diplomacy play was to understand who we are. And I had to sweat a lot to tell them who we are, okay? That we are who we really are, okay? And I think that in the end of the day, we're not like happy to have wars or fights. We're trying to deter our enemies from doing that. That's why I think that the Israeli defense systems is using so much of mutual deterrence, who deters whom, and stuff like that. And what do we have and what we don't have, the arsenal we have, the arsenal we don't have, claiming to be having, and stuff like that. So this is something that has to be eventually not only understood to us, ourselves, from within the Israeli system, but to be communicated rightly to other nations too.
Yeah.
Knowing that we have our own policy from time to time.
Communicating rightly is important. Yossi Cohen, thank you so much. This was a fascinating conversation, and thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Anit. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Yossi. Very good to talk to you. Well, I think he was very candid with us. He didn't go as far as, you know, laying into Netanyahu by name, but that bit where he said, you know, if you're in the job, you have to take responsibility, it cannot be read as anything other than a pretty sharp criticism of the man he once advised and of whom he was once described as the heir. I think that was strong. I mean, how did you react, Yoni?
Listen, I mean, I think, first of all, even if we didn't have the whole political aspect of his ambitions, talking to someone who's up until 2.5 years ago head of Mossad is something that's very interesting to me. The places where he goes deeply into politics and his politics is something I haven't heard him do even in Hebrew, which is to say, I am from the political right, but I'm very liberal on certain issues. His considerations, yes or no, to go into politics, why yes, why no, that was very interesting. The buzz around Yossi Cohen is the same buzz that we heard around Benny Gantz in 2018, right before he was entering politics, with two main differences. One, Yossi Cohen is markedly less naive in the world of Israeli politics. He knows Netanyahu better than probably most people on earth. And so, and of course, as he says, he comes from the center-right, not from where Gantz came into politics. So he has a lot of chances. You see that by the way that the people who support Netanyahu have begun to attack him more and more. This is a very, very interesting figure to follow in the next couple of months and years.
I couldn't agree more. And I think a couple of other things that leapt out. One, about Palestinian state, he didn't rule it out in principle. He talked about timing, but I thought there will be people on the right who will be discomforted by that. It showed he was thinking of it. If you're the White House and listening to that, you'll be thinking, okay, we could do business with that guy. Thought that was interesting. When we asked him about, are you considering politics? I was expecting the answer you would get from, you know, the British politician, there's no vacancy, that, you know, no point talking about hypotheticals. On the contrary, he said, I'm thinking about it. Yeah. And, you know, with family and kind of weighing it up. He all but admitted that he's drawing up, you know, pros and cons on a notepad. You know, he's weighing this up and said so. And I admired the kind of directness of that because often politicians don't admit that they are ambitious. And he was admitting that. And as for that socially liberal but hawkish on the security questions, I think that's a stance that could make him slot in kind of anywhere. That's not just confined to Likud. I mean, in a way, is that so far from some of those, from the Benny Gantz blue and white party? It's not so far. So he's got some options there. He played that quite well. But I also thought that it was more candid than we had expected.
So, awards, sir?
Yes, awards. Well, we talked before, didn't we, about people who are around the world quite keen to, you know, avoid describing what happened, the crimes committed by Hamas, by their name. And this week, Professor Judith Butler, who is, you know, a big figure in the long-running and often very bitter arguments around gender, spoke at a conference where she said, you know, we can argue about whether we like it or not, but what Hamas did on October 7th is armed resistance, not terrorism. It's armed resistance. Big applause. It's wrapped around in a whole lot of sort of theorizing, as you would expect from Professor Butler. But I think, you know, it was pretty clear that she wore her meaning. She said she didn't, you know, didn't like it. Wouldn't be her way of doing things, but we've got to acknowledge this is an armed resistance against occupation. I think we can all give recognition to that. We don't have to debate the terminology. We're going to give her a chutzpah award.
We can debate the terminology. We can say it's, you know, when reality becomes farce and could be written as a satire program. You said what there is to say about this. It's a sad day when someone like her says this. It's sad. It connects to what we discussed about the apologists and the people who would overlook things like rape just so it would fit their worldview.
And by the way, there were people even on sort of, as it were, the, you know, what should be Judith Butler's side, who were saying armed resistance doesn't include actually killing children and the innocents and civilians and rape. Armed resistance, there are people who absolutely use that language to talk about hitting military targets and occupied peoples do have rights and so on. They don't extend to the kinds of barbarity and crimes we saw on October the 7th.
So, Mensch is something that I usually, you know, that I have my Women's Day, International Women's Day rant around this time, because it always seems to me, and not that I you know, I have all of the respect for women organizations and for their work all throughout the year, but the fact that, you know, we are still living in a time in which women get a day when they deserve 365 days is something I always found quite troubling. But in this case, I would want to use it to talk a little bit about the heroism of Israeli women on all aspects and on all levels, whether it is the women hostages who went through hell on earth and came back to tell the story and to call for the release of more hostages. There are 17 young women still held by Hamas as we speak. If it is the heroism of the mothers of hostages that are fighting relentlessly to get them released, people like Rachel Goldberg, who we talked about, unforgettable episode of this podcast. If it is the women soldiers, warriors fighting on October 7th, before and after October 7th, this is a country that has women heroes, many in abundance. They are sadly not enough of them in leadership. We are in a government in which no party is led in the coalition is led by women. By the way, I think with the fact that Merav Mikhaeli left the head of the, said she will no longer run the Labor Party, there are no women at all leading parties in the Israeli Knesset. There are no senior women in ministerial positions in the government. That is a tragedy. The more we look into what happened on October 7th, the women who warned of what Hamas was planning, it was women, and they weren't listened to. All this leads me to just say that we need to respect these women, and we need to understand that the more women are in higher places and important places, the better country we will be and the better the world will be.
We spoke at different stages of the war about how on so many levels it was, women were at the center of this. And we, you know, it was part of our earlier conversation about sexual violence. One way and another, this has been very much about the women. I think that you can mark International Women's Day no better way than going back to that episode that you referred to, our conversation with Rachel Goldberg-Polin. We called the episode Motherland. It was at the very end that I think the last one we did in December of 2023. So do listen to that. And I absolutely take your point about that. We should say that if you are getting a lot out of Unholy, lots of people are writing in different forms, but you know, it does really help if you rate and review wherever you get your podcast. So thank you all the people who are doing that.
And we will say our thank yous to Gaia Glaser, Omer Primat, and Omri Barak. And we will meet next week, Jonathan.
See you then, Yonit.